If you care about your equality, you have to care about everybody's equality. You're in or you're out. There are no half measures.
Welcome to Nouscast, a podcast from Nous Group. I'm Deborah May, a principal of Nous. For anyone who isn't familiar with Nous, we're an award-winning, Australian-owned management consulting firm of 400 people across Australia and in London. This year, Nous is celebrating its 20th anniversary. To mark the occasion, we've launched Beyond 2020, an event series that will explore the big ideas and stories shaping Australia's future, featuring leading thinkers from Australia and around the world. You'll be able to catch each of these discussions right here on Nouscast. In this episode, we're exploring diversity and the power of inclusion as a means of tapping into the unheard, unsaid, and unseen in Australian workplaces. The core question we reflect on is how we can tap into the wide, varied range of experiences, backgrounds, and expertise to deliver the best possible outcomes for organisations, our communities, and our nation. And equally importantly, how to ensure that we create and sustain equal opportunities for individuals of all backgrounds to contribute, participate, and achieve their potential. So now, speaking from Nous in Melbourne, here's the Victorian Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People, Justin Muhammad, sharing his perspective on tapping into the unsaid, unheard, and unseen.
First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land which we meet on and the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I don't just do that lightheartedly. This is where we do business. It's where I've moved and lived and spent most of the last nearly 12 months now. And it's a very fertile piece of land in Australia about Aboriginal affairs. And my story will probably move a little bit around that, but I just want to let that know. So I've met Ro in Shepparton and Cummeragunja, the great mission, which had so many leaders that came through there, which petitioned the King and petitioned the Victorian Australian government, a whole range of things. And this state has, it's not here because it's not so progressive just because it's decided to do this in the last 10, 20 years. It's been pushed by the Aboriginal people for over 200 years to be progressive. So I'll leave that there. I want to tell a bit of a story about my life as I grew up and up until I finished school, because when I was talking about what am I going to share tonight, I don't really share too much about myself. I was in my early 20s when that incident happened. I'll call it an incident or a stance. That game was played at Victory Park where Collingwood was, and that stance that he made the headlines. Obviously, that photo's become quite iconic. But most people see the photo as, Nicky's lifting his jumper up, pointing to his skin or his chest, saying, I'm proud. But for an Aboriginal man who was in their 20s, probably similar age to Ro when all this happened, I went through life like as Nicky was probably doing playing AFL. I want to be the best in what the rules are, what the circumstances are. I'm going to try to be my best. But no matter how hard Nicky played, and he was obviously the best on the ground of that game, there was still a reason to attack not him as a footballer, but him as a person or his race, and that's what he was standing up for. So when I saw that photo, it was like, it's a bit like what Rose said, is that you get all these positions and titles and you're on these boards and whatever, but underneath all that, you're the same person. And even though he was representing the St Kilda Football Club, apart from all that, he was an Aboriginal man who that's what he was proud of, and that was his message. Not, I'm a footballer, I'm proud of that, or I'm proud of my club. Apart from all that, I'm proud of as an Aboriginal man. And as a young 20-year-old, seeing that and saw the stance that he made back then when it wasn't quite as progressive, but I don't know how progressive it's got when you see the Adam Goods and the Eddie Betts sort of scenarios that we live out today. But that picture has resonated. It gives me strength when I look at it, because it defies what the people in the bystanders can keep trying to pull you down because of not what you do, it's or how well you do it or how bad you do it, but just for the sheer fact of your race. So I'll rewind back now when I'm first went to school, and I went to I think in Queensland we call it preschool. I think I was 5 years old, And I grew up in a community, and my mum and dad, and most of my people, most of the people I hung around with were my cousins and extended family and community. So a lot of black people. And I went to preschool, and my first day, I remember, I was 5 years old, but I do remember because I went home to mum and said, there's so many white kids out there. I couldn't believe how many white kids there were. And I think there was only me and another person that were black. And so I went, that was a bit of a culture shock for me. Mum dressed me in a little turtleneck, you know, knitted jumper and all the rest of it. In Queensland, boy, mind you. Long pants. And when I dig into mum's background, she wanted to make sure that I didn't look different, wanted me to be the same because there's all these other things going on in her mind, sending her little, her favourite child, as I say to the others, off to this environment which has for so long been a place of, you know, tearing families apart. So within my very first week, apart from feeling that, about halfway through that week, and I remember the other, that's only two things I remember, that and this, was the first time I faced racism. When another student or person in my class challenged me on my colour or called me black. I can't remember the exact word, but it put me in a spot. And I said something like, well, we're all the same. And anyway, the teacher told my mum, and mum kind of patched me up a little bit afterwards. And get along with it. And in my time of growing up, my family, that was the way they coped. It was about, well, you just got to toughen up. You've got to just dust yourself off and move on because no one's going to give you a chance. And my grandfather used to say these words and still ring in my head. You've got to work harder. You've got to play sport better. You've got to, you know, dress better just to get close to being equal. And that was something which was, you know, drummed into all our kids and his grandkids' head. I don't know if that's really good, but we've done okay. But then I went off to school, and right through my primary school, I was always reminded that I wasn't quite the same. I was always reminded about my Aboriginality, that I was black, that I looked a bit different. That was always the case. But it wasn't until I think it was year seven, and in year seven, I had a experience where I was in a playground, and it was probably one of the worst years of my life at school. But I think every week I got into I got five children myself and said, you don't go to violence to sort it. You can sort it other ways. But back then, there's a lot of fights in the schoolyard. And I think once a week I had a fight with somebody who called me names of coon, bung, nigger, whatever. Just because of who I was, not because I did anything wrong. They just walked past me and say it. Be spat in the face, you know. The way I thought I had to address it was to be a man, and to fight with that with my hands, or to, you know, take them on. And there was one lunch time I did this, and the person I got into the fight with, I got the better of him, because when you fight so often, you got to be better, or you get beaten up. So it wasn't because of choice. I went off to class, and the teacher came up and said, what happened? And I kind of said my version, he said his version. And then I went in the class, and then I was at the school's a Christian Brothers school from grade 5 to year 12, very big school, a lot of discipline. And halfway through my last class of school, I got the deputy principal came down, knocked on the door, said, Justin, Muhammad, you need to go to the principal's office. And I was about 12-year-old at that stage. So I walked up to the principal's office, and I walked into the print, which is, you don't normally get into the principal's office. You knew something was going to happen because they had the straps back in those days. And you weren't going up there for a gold star or anything. And I walked in, and there was the young boy of my age that I had to fight with. There was these two parents and the principal all sitting like in a little semicircle. And there was one seat there for me to sit in. And I was 12-year-old, and I sat there, and I heard, it was kind of like, it was happening, but it wasn't happening. And I just, at that point, I thought, this is not fair. I don't know what I didn't know what wasn't fair, but I just knew it wasn't fair. My parents weren't called. And I walked out of there, and it was like, I was chastised for using violence. And even though, no matter how hard I tried to plead my case, it just didn't get listened to. And I walked out of there, and that changed my idea about education and school. I just really did. I thought, this is not fair. And about 6 months later, I was in the classroom and another teacher, and I think my grade started dropping. I started kind of, you know, playing up to the fact, this is not fair. This school doesn't really want me. So I lived to that a little bit. But one of the teachers in front of everyone said, you know, pulled me out. He said, see this kid here? And I was at the front. And there's only myself was the only Aboriginal kid in the class. You're going to be nothing more than a garbage collector. And that again kind of hit me. And I said, something like smart back and said, I'll never collect your garbage anyway if I was. I got detention for that, I think. So then that was another sort of reaffirming where I sat in this whole space. So that end of that year, I left that school. I went to a public school because I wasn't doing well. Mum thought it'd be better to get me into a public school. I didn't tell Mum and Dad didn't kind of, because I didn't think it was going to do anything because nothing could ever be done. That's how you felt, disempowered. And the system probably had an unconscious way of doing that. And I went to a public school. And within the first 2 months, I was voted in as class captain, and this is like a new beginning, you know, like kids love me, and I was a class captain, and I was not too bad at playing footy, so that was good, and I remember during that, about 4 or 5 weeks after, the teacher came in, and the class was doing things they shouldn't be, and very disruptive, and the teacher singled me out as the class captain. I was the only Aboriginal kid in the class again. I was a class captain. And he took my class captain badge off and said, you're the worst class captain we've ever had. And then he gave it to the kid who was the ringleader who caused all this trouble. So by that stage, I was in year 8, and that was the end of my any appreciation, and my grades went right downhill. I went to school just to cause havoc and not to do anything much more than try to get through without being too damaged. And by the time I was in year 10, I left the school system. And it wasn't until I got later in life that I thought, well, maybe I should, and I got a job, and I think it probably saved me because I would have spent another 2 years of just being on a road of destruction. And then I got into work, and I thought I want to better myself when I was about 19 and started realizing that if I did study, I could amount to something. And the full twist to this was, I was the CEO of Reconciliation Australia, and it was about 3 years ago. I flew to Gladstone to launch this massive deal that was happening with Port Curtis, which was going to work with the traditional owners, which is part of my traditional owner group, and they were going to provide this fund, and it was a really big deal. So I turn up there as the Reconciliation CEO, keynote speaker, walk into the room, everyone's kind of, you know, as they do, here's your chair, Mr. Muhammad, and all the rest. And I'm standing up to do my speech, and I notice this person in the crowd. And it was one of my old school teachers. He was a lot grayer, and I know this person. Then afterwards, I was avoided him because this is the same teacher that said I wouldn't amount to anything. But there was a little boy inside of me going, I was the man, not I was the main attraction. But I wanted to avoid him because I didn't want to. And he came up and he said, you know, well done, you've done so well. And I didn't say anything back to him. But it just still felt like it was yesterday when it happened. And that's the pain. So I don't want you to feel sorry for that story I've just told. I want you to see what you could do in your life to make sure that doesn't happen to the next child or the next young person. And my work career has kind of gone, and people say, how'd you get to where I am? I don't know, other than I just want to make sure that the people that the have-nots, the people that haven't been so blessed with good parents, people that haven't been so supported by good elders and community and knowing who you are, that I could provide some space for that or challenge others to do that for people. And I want to leave you with one little thing. If people say to you that they don't see colour, they're totally on the wrong track, because you can't make change if you can't see difference. You just can't. They are, you know, you just can't say, well, everyone's the same. Everyone should equal. Everyone's treated equally. Well, some people have to be treated differently for the right reasons. So you need to do that. And if you want to have engagement and you want to have more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people in your workforce or wherever you are, be prepared. You might have to move sideways sooner or later because they will want to move and keep progressing and not be held down. And sadly, some of the progression that I've seen with employment and education, there's a ceiling on it for a lot of Aboriginal people and for young people. And we've got to break that ceiling. I think this state can do it. I think many of you in this room can do it, but yous are the ones that can make that happen, not us, the 3%. So, the last question, I'll finish with this, about who have I moved or who's moved aside or given me an opportunity. I can't think of any white person that's done that, sadly. The people that have been Aboriginal leaders and elders who have done that and have encouraged me and have moved aside and given me their blessings full heartedly to take on the space that they occupied. And that's why I'm here today. And you wanted me to be honest, that's exactly, no one's given me a leg up except for my community who's been there, who's been in the background and supporting that. So hopefully there'll be more different people up here in years to come in my seat who are saying they can name firsthand people who have opened up ways and have stepped aside for them to have the opportunities they deserve.
That was Justin Muhammad, the Victorian Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People, sharing his powerful personal story of growing up black in a largely white Australia, facing gut-wrenching racism and discrimination, and his journey to becoming a highly respected leader in his field, improving the lives of young Aboriginal people around Australia. Next, we have Jemana El-Matra, CEO of the Australian Muslim Women's Centre for Human Rights.
They've really made my job impossible, but I'm going to try to hold your attention. Tim was saying that not to be worried about being provocative, so I'm going to do just that. In the way I see the world from who I am, as a survivor of war, as part Lebanese, part Syrian, part Turkish, part Egyptian, as somebody who's migrated to Australia, someone who's extremely left, to me, I'm normal and you're strange. So when we talk about diversity, it's really about me trying to fit you guys in, because it is always such a leap for me to often understand where, mainstream Australia is coming from. Because I don't come from that space. I've had those experiences where people have really worked hard to sort of push you down because of your difference. And actually this is connected to the photo that I have brought with me of my beautiful grandmother who passed away recently. And my beautiful grandmother used to be described as a force of nature. And so she was very unique and grew up in a village where people literally gave up on trying to change her because she was a force of nature. Everything was neutral to her. She just kept pushing forward. And I think that, claim to oneself as normal, that has come to me as normal because of my grandmother, is something that a lot of other people don't have. And so the diminishment of the person is always a lot stronger. And I think it's really worth thinking about, in the last few years, I think about Australia as being home. And I think if you're a survivor of war, you really never have a home because you are so different from everybody else around you. But if I think about Australia as my home, two things have come to my mind recently. One of them is that we had a same-sex marriage survey a few years ago. And we had it despite the fact that most of us were very pro same-sex marriage. And we were still dragged through a year of our national life so that one group of people could diminish another group of people. What did heterosexual people have to lose by same-sex people marrying? What is it that the mainstream was going to lose? And the fact is, there was nothing to lose. We were only ever going to be enriched. And yet we fought and fought and fought. And my husband, who's a therapist, used to have people come in and say, people in tears would come in and say, but why? Why are people so offended by who I am? And that didn't actually stop us from trying to push down what is fundamentally intrinsic to our nature. Human diversity is always chafing at the bit. We are designed for diversity. We survive through diversity, but we will do everything to kill it off. We use the police to kill it off. We use religion to kill it off. We use society to kill it off. We use hate. And I wonder at what point it will become sufficient for us to say, It's okay. Actually, we're only going to grow from this. And if you have lived through war, you basically know that it is about people killing each other over identity. Anybody who tells you it's about resources doesn't understand human nature. War is always about identity. And so when we talk about inclusion, inclusion is not about a nice, feel-good, civilized society. Inclusion is really about maintaining our fundamental humanity. And that humanity is always about all of us. Diversity isn't about mainstream Australia fitting in minorities, because minorities too have to work on diversity. The fact that I'm Muslim doesn't mean that diversity and trying to bring in difference into my organisation is irrelevant. In fact, it's harder for me because I'm more likely to be treated as the one who should be included rather than the one who has an onus to include. And so it is sort of undoing that thinking. Before I go on to some of the things that I've learned as a manager, I wanted to share with you, because I've been asked to share a story about my own personal experience of discrimination and so forth. And I want to share one story to lighten the mood a little bit. But I attend Q Society meetings. I'm not sure if everybody here knows Q Society. Q Society is dedicated to educating Australians about the threat of Islam and Muslims in Australia. And I started attending the meetings because, as a CEO, I need to know everything that's relevant to Muslims. And I don't want to be the CEO who reads it in a book. I want to be the person who's had the experience. I went there with a couple of friends. One was Jewish, who wanted to relive her mother's footpath. Her mother used to spy on Nazis in the UK when she was quite young. And I went with another young Muslim woman who I was sort of mentoring at the time, and she said to me, you know, if I wasn't Muslim, I would be really scared of Muslims because the narrative was so compelling, yeah? And I walked away from that meeting actually feeling absolutely nothing and feeling quite surprised about that because I am more of a sort of emotional intelligence committed sort of person. And I realized, because when people speak about you in that way, it literally is a type of death. Something in you is pushed down and you're negated so profoundly that actually you can't feel, you can't be that person. In terms of diversity in organizations, it's like I said, this isn't just something for mainstream Australia. Diversity in terms of the nation we're trying to build is for all of us. Migrants have to invest in diversity. You can't just say it's really important for Muslims to have their rights, but be totally homophobic or anti, or sort of unaware of the plight of Aboriginal and Indigenous communities. If you care about your equality, you have to care about everybody's equality. You're in or you're out, is my view on this. There are no half measures. In terms of the managerial stuff, a couple of things I've learned is that, you know, targeted promotions, mentorships, additional training, really spanning out and seeing who's around is really crucial. In our employment, when I came to the centre and as I've developed its employment policies, I changed the employment policy from being Muslim only to 80% Muslim, because I wanted to bring in the rest of Australia. If you're going to talk about and develop your policies in terms of the rest of Australia, you need to be seeing it on a daily work basis. Staff have for a long time tried to get their head around why I don't choose just the ordinary Muslim to employ. I'm interested in Muslim women who are no longer Muslim. They've converted out or they've become atheist, because that is a Muslim experience. That's one thing Muslims do. Muslims who are gay, Muslims who are of different class, Muslims who've experienced war, Muslims who've experienced torture because of political activism. And I do that not so much, I mean, it is trying to aim at equality, But the thing that I have discovered is that if you're going to talk about diversity from an organizational perspective and you're looking to be agents of social change, you have to have a very complex, calibrated narrative and set of strategies. And you can't do that if you're all the same. Yeah. I can talk about being very progressive and I can commit myself to, trying to be well informed, but I'm only ever going to be Jemana. You know, I'm never going to be somebody else who's grown up as an Indigenous man. And I can't pretend that I do. Bringing in these very specific types of experiences not only calibrates your organization's narrative and strategies, but actually tends to make you a better manager as well. You've got a lot more people feeding in to you. I'm quite an introverted person. I'm quite an awkward nerd. So for me, other people's experiences are really crucial to help me even get outside my own personal character and to be able to leap out and connect up with other people. And so it isn't just about you doing something for someone else. You actually get so much in return. The other thing I would say is don't do diversity for diversity's sake, yeah? No. I have seen people be employed in positions around, changing the policies of an organization around diversity or Aboriginal communities or LGBTI communities. And these people go into the organization all ready to go, and there really isn't a job for them to do. That's a very diminishing thing to do to a person. If you're going to take that gamble, if you're going to say you want to do that work, then don't do it unless you're absolutely 100%, and you're going to use the very rare resource that you have. Working with difference is hard, not because it's hard to bring in difference, but because it's hard to let go of the degree to which we've normalized exclusion. We have a lot of unlearning to do, and some of that is really quite unconscious. And for managers, that is especially hard. Like even the best managers you speak to, if you say to them, what's really difficult about management? Lots of people will say to you, oh, it's the people stuff. I love the strategic work. I don't mind the administrative stuff. People management is really, really hard. So then why do we not speak about this? Why do we not speak about how difficult it is to do some of the diversity stuff? How it is that sometimes we think we're people who are progressive, but find that we've hit a wall with how somebody expresses their diversity. We have staff who are very angry at the way they've been treated all their lives, and they want you as a manager to make it better. There is a deafening silence, both I think in the corporate government and NGO sector that should know a lot better, around how bloody hard this work is and how much support we all need to give each other. This is something that Australia needs as a nation and organisations need for their own development. And unless we're speaking to each other and developing more strategies, keep in mind the strategies we have now around coaching and mentoring and stuff like that, is stuff that we developed many, many years ago and mostly for women, I think. So we need to add to our skill set, and the only way to do that is to express some of the vulnerability that you've spoken about, Deborah, and actually talk about, we're trying to do this, but it's really hard, or I'm trying to include this worker, but they're really angry, and I can't undo all the injustice they've experienced, and I just need this worker to do their job, you know. Or I have a worker, every time they leave the house, they're either spat at because they're black, or somebody pulls off their hijab. What do you do about that as a manager? You cannot be with your worker 24 hours a day, and yet it's important that you're able to speak to that and help the person process their experience. So thank you.
Some thought-provoking insights there from Jemana El-Matra on the work that goes into making diversity and inclusion work in practice. Many people struggle to talk openly about the challenges of making diversity work, and yet, as Jemana eloquently put it, when it comes to equality, you're in or you're out. And now, A final word from me as we wrapped up on this reflective, provocative, and inspirational collection of experiences and stories in Melbourne.
Thank you all very much for sharing your own personal stories and for creating a level of awareness and understanding of some of the experiences that we may not notice are happening for some of our people around us and indeed amongst us, working alongside us. There are many people in this room who share some of these experiences, who share aspects of these identities that choose not to display them or be visible because of what can happen and does happen, and we heard how it does happen. We need to move beyond the conversations around diversity and move into a conversation about inclusion, which is about integration. It's about understanding and recognizing that different people experience the workplace, our organizations, their lives differently to us. And we can't make assumptions, but we do. We can't actually fix it, but we try, unless we create the space for everybody to participate in the decision-making, in the problem-solving, in the creativity and in the innovation that's possible. So integration is about creating a whole that's much bigger than the sum of the parts. We need to move, we must move beyond those the parts and into the whole. And we can do that together, side by side, by expanding the space, by allowing all of us to work in that space, to be in that space together. So thank you very much for the contribution you've made. Thank you very much for listening tonight. And I'm hoping you've heard some things in this space that you can reflect on, you can think about in terms of what you might do individually and collectively to expand the space.
Our thanks to speakers Justin Muhammad, the Victorian Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People, and Jemana El-Matra, CEO of the Australian Muslim Women's Centre for Human Rights, for their contributions shared in this episode. Our thanks also to Ro Allen, the Victorian Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, as well as Kevin Stone, CEO of VALID, or the Victorian Advocacy League for Individual Disability, whose contributions were featured in part one of this two-part episode on tapping into the unsaid, unheard and unseen. If you're interested in learning more about NAUS and how our diversity and inclusion programs and services will help you tap into the unsaid, unseen and unheard and leverage the full diversity of talent in your workplace, you can find out more at www.nausgroup.com.au.